Hello everyone. So, it's just me today for the moment because we had a little bit of a technical difficulty, and unfortunately Matt and I lost, I lost the first 7 minutes of the recording. And so I wanted to begin today, before we jump into the part of the recording that we do have, just to give you a little bit of context about who Matt is and what his work and research is about and what we'll be discussing. It's a brilliant episode, by the way. Matt is a fantastic and brilliant and insightful and clever guy, and it was all around really impressive, and I really had a great conversation. But so just for some context, you know, Matt is a health coach and has been studying the human mind in various forms for the past 25 years. And this was due to a history of personal experience that he had, which you'll hear about in the episode, about the way that we communicate and store memories and images. Now, Matt's work focuses very much around stress and what he calls emotional memory imaging. And to give you a little bit of a context of what emotional memory images are, I'm going to read a little bit of an excerpt from his website. So, mental health problems and many chronic conditions stem from emotional memory images, EMIs, created as a result of adverse traumatic experiences. When these EMIs are triggered, we are immediately transported back to the original event, leaving us helpless. If we come across an event that remotely resembles the initial trauma, then our subconscious mind triggers a stress response, otherwise known as the fight or flight or freeze response. The survival response at the time of the original event engaged our body's natural alarm system. Whatever decision that our subconscious mind chose then is the one that will continue to influence our perception of reality today. As we get older, we would like to think that we get wiser, but our unconscious mind never forgets. Survival is paramount, and your mind will continually react and reenact your past until the EMI is removed or processed. In order to respond quickly enough to the danger in our environment, blood and oxygen are diverted away from our thinking brain to the reptilian brain, and the subconscious is now in charge. Our subconscious signals the amygdala, the fear center, to prepare the body for conflict. Suddenly, we are no longer in control of the situation and can only react with fight, flight, or freeze. Unaware that the real trigger of this stress response occurred in our past, we retrofit the cause of this stress. Feelings in the present can be deceptive. The source of our problems may not be what we are currently engaged in. However, we rationalize the irrational to justify unconsciously triggered behavior that doesn't serve us. Now, what Matt's saying here is basically that when traumatic things happen to us in the past, they get stored in our mind in what he calls an emotional memory image. And if that is not correctly and sufficiently processed by our brain due to the nature of trauma that often happens, then anytime something resembles that situation, our fight or flight mode immediately kicks in and overrides our thinking capacity, right? So the emotional intensity is too strong and we go back into fight, flight, or freeze mode. And this can happen even when the situation at present isn't dangerous at all. You know, someone says in your past, now something mean on the internet, or you have a task to do that's very stressful, that's related to something that you have connected to a trauma. And Matt and his team have developed an amazing study, on all of these things, and a tool called Mind Reset. It's an app, and it basically utilizes a variety of tools where in about 2 minutes, you can disconnect from that fight, flight, or freeze mode, if it's not too intense, of course, and then think about that memory in a new way that basically aims to resolve the emotional memory image and process it so that you're not triggered as extensively by the stresses in your ordinary life today. Now, the fight, flight, or freeze mode is a very important part of our evolutionary history and of our lives today, because survival is the most important thing, generally speaking, and our brain will react in a way that it does whatever it needs to do to survive this moment so that it can continue living. However, the consequences of that sometimes linger on for, you know, days, weeks, months, years into the future, and if not dealt with properly, can lead to all kinds of psychological and physiological problems, you know, health problems and so forth. And Matt's working on a way for us to basically retake control over these situations so that the stress in our lives and these ordinary things that give us such intense anxiety and, you know, potentially even like depressive symptoms and exacerbated stress responses, that we can do something about it. And this Mind Reset app is one of the coolest ways that I've ever seen it done before. Now, just as a disclaimer, you know, this app is not necessarily for everyone, and you should do it, you know, at your own risk and under the guise of a physician or mental health professional. But that's, of course, true of everything that we say on this podcast. I hope you enjoy. Again, I apologize for the weird break in the conversation and that it picks up midway, but you'll catch on pretty quick. And I hope the episode is as enjoyable for you as it was for both of us. We will speak soon.
Okay, cool. So I'll use the track from that beginning 5 or so minutes. We don't need to restart the whole thing.
Good, because I'll have forgotten.
Yeah. Okay, so to continue with where we were at, right? So we were roughly talking about the fear response and its impact on emotional, you know, creating emotional memory images and the sort of subsequent consequences of that developmentally, and how that sort of leads to stress. And so maybe it's a good time to just pause a second just to clarify what you mean by an emotional memory image, an EMI.
Yeah. I was about to say fortunately, but I suppose it is. Fortunately for me, I have been born with conductive deafness, so that I don't have any bones in my ears. So basically, so long as sound is loud enough, it comes through my skull.
Hmm.
But we didn't find that out until I was age 25.
Wow.
So at age 25, I discover that I haven't actually been using my ears. So that was kind of cool, you know, in a sort of, wow, here's a whole new world for me to explore. So I always, always, always would watch people's face when I'm having a conversation. But I thought everybody did that. It turns out that actually not a lot of people do, because they use these devices on the side of their head.
Right.
Now, that was such a revelation, you know, at the age 25 to realize, wow, not everybody does it the way I do it.
Right.
Yeah? And so that sort of started a whole new journey in my life of just exploring communication and how human beings actually get by without using their eyes.
Hmm. And so did you get that like fixed, so to speak, or is it just, that's just how it is?
Well, this piece that's allowing me to have the podcast, the hearing side, is at the same time when I had the operation, the exploratory operation for my hearing, the surgeon made a tiny connection and he said, it might last 2 weeks, you never know. But all these years later, it's still hanging on there, whatever connection he made, which gives me enough to sort of use the telephone, etc. But my other side is, you know, it's for decoration purposes.
It's a good thing it's there, because if you didn't have the ear, you just have a hole or whatever.
You know? Plus I'd have nowhere to hang my spectacles.
Yeah, so, that's true.
So in the last few years, they've come, they're really handy to have.
Yeah. Okay.
So there I am with that little piece of hearing. But for me, it, it was about the communication network. How, if I manage to get that far in life without realizing it, mm-hmm. what other layers and depths of communication are going on, you know, for me and, you know, for the rest of us that we're not noticing?
Yeah.
And that really led me down a very, very narrow path. But it seemed at the time that there's nothing new here. People must have seen this, must have discovered this. But the further down the path we got, the more we realized, wow, we're onto something.
Mm-hmm.
We've all noticed when somebody gets you, if the garage mechanic tells you that, gives you a very large bill, you know, for how much the damage to your car will be, or the plumber, or, you know, we've all seen people go,
yeah.
You know, what's the, why do people give that intake of breath? And then when you look into the science behind it, there's a reason that we take an intake of breath. That mm-hmm. intake of breath is arming our system up, because fear is at hand, yeah, and our system is going to want to engage in something in the next few seconds. So that's why we take that sharp intake of breath.
Mm.
Yeah. So people at home would be thinking, oh, wow, I thought it was just because I was about to pass out at the thought of the bill.
Yeah.
But so we all have this built in. Yeah. If something bad's coming, we brace ourselves. Yeah, that. And when we're watching someone chat, if you said to say you haven't seen them with their partner lately, and if you see so how's Charlie, and they take that breath, we know how Charlie is.
Yeah, you know, we don't need to say anything.
The discussion's over. We won't be discussing Charlie any further. So there's so much beautiful, rich data to be mined in the nothing.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and that's really where my work is focused. It's in this small area, a split second, that gives us so much information, which allows for our survival.
Yeah.
But the beauty of it is, in nature, animals shake this off.
Yeah.
The Robert Sapolsky's book, Zebras, Why Zebras, don't get ulcers. That's the one. Yeah. And brilliant book. I didn't like it because he did sort of pick on Sellier quite a bit, and Sellier's he's my pop star, right?
Right.
So when you read the book, it made sense. The zebra's under attack, or the animal's under attack. Once the attack is over, providing they survive, they shake it off. Now, I'm a little older than you, so I remember when we were children.
Mm-hmm.
If people had suffered a shock, we'd give them a cup of tea with 28 sugars in it. Have some sugars, it'd calm your nerves. Yeah. Now we find sugar probably sends you off at the other tangent, but or have a brandy or something to calm your nerves.
Yeah.
So we were ultra sensitive to shock and our nervous system.
Yeah.
But animals shake it off. So
yeah.
What has shifted in us, or what is it about us that causes us not to shake it off?
Yeah. You see not what to I mean? Complete, yeah, we don't complete that stress cycle.
We don't complete the cycle. We stay in pause, which is the main area of freeze that we target, the pause, which is freeze. Yeah, because flight or fight are both actively doing something. So we're burning up the adrenaline, the cortisol, etc. But if we're in pause, we're in a freeze response. Now, the talk I gave last night was to show exactly how the freeze response impacts our ability to communicate and our ability to actually assert ourselves, because we will not fight and we won't run away.
Yeah.
So if, for example, let's say a totalitarian government, for example, yeah?
Yeah.
If you could find a totalitarian government, I mean, where would you find one nowadays? But let's say you could.
It's hard to say.
It's hard to say. Yeah, very difficult. So if you could find a totalitarian government, then if you were able to find a totalitarian government who knew how to use, let's say, propaganda, for example, mainstream media or the television set, if they knew what to do with those gadgets, they could very quickly download an emotional memory image on screen that would flip the bulk of the population into a trance.
Yeah, the fear response.
The fear response. And it would automatically make them compliant. So this is a conversation I'm hoping to have next month with Matthias Desmet.
Yeah.
It's because Matthias has written a wonderful book on totalitarianism. But I'm
so not often those two words are in the same sentence.
Sorry.
It was just a funny point.
It is funny. I get excited about all of the wrong. I'm really looking at what drives these things.
Yeah.
So it's exciting to look at the structure. But obviously from a humanitarian position, I mean, it's horrific. It's terrifying. It's absolutely horrendous. But when you look at how they put it together, then you can figure out how to undo it.
Yes.
So that's, I suppose, my skill is figuring out how pieces go together. So that, did you ever play Kaplunk? And you just, you pull pieces out. What's it? The modern version you guys use is pieces of wood. What's it called? Jenga?
Jenga.
So you're trying to pull the pieces out and keep it upright.
Without collapsing the
tower. Well, for me, I look at the whole process and think, what's the least amount I could do that would cause the whole thing to collapse?
Right.
So it's a little bit more exciting.
Yeah, and listen, I mean, it's so important to understand these things from a social and psychological perspective, because it's real, right? It's not pretty, but it's real. And even in non-authoritarian governments, it's happening anyway, right? And it's important for people to understand that. And, you know, when one of the things is like, well, when our sympathetic nervous system is activated, right, which is that fight, flight, freeze, there's a few variations of it, but like when that system gets activated,
faint,
exactly.
They're all in there, yeah.
Submit, you know, like it really just depends. But that system tends to be much more primitive in your brain, and it assumes control, meaning your higher cognitive functioning, like reasoning, logic,
out the window.
Yeah, it just shuts down. And that's not anyone's fault. That's just the design of our brains, right? And it actually makes sense from an evolutionary perspective why that happens, because it doesn't matter if your survival is perceived to be at risk. What matters the most is surviving what's happening now. Now, when that goes on for a long time, that's when we get into really murky waters in terms of how that impacts us. But in a moment-to-moment experience, like, you actually want that to be the case. You don't want to be thinking about things. You want your instincts to keep you alive so that you can stay alive, ultimately.
Yeah. You've really, that's exactly where we are. It's such a beautiful system that we have. It is designed to make sure that we survive.
Mm-hmm.
Number one. Now, the problem is, because we're human, we have this thing called time.
Yes.
The animal kingdom do not share a watch with us.
Yeah.
And that's why I always say that rabbits do not begin meditation class at 12 o'clock in the afternoon.
Yeah.
They don't need it.
It's just always.
It's always. You see what I mean? If you had a conversation with a wild rabbit and said, you know, so what do you do to relax? I mean, it's going to look at you, you know, and like you're some sort of crazy thing.
Yeah.
Because what do you mean relax? They're just in now. They're present.
Yeah.
And yet here we are with the clock, the watch, which is all invented basically just to make sure that we got our butts out of bed and got to work and, you know, and work for the slave masters for X number of hours every day until one day the clock ticked and we die. You know, and then fortunately we had more children so they can put them back in the machine to make more. Mm-hmm. Did I digress? I'm back again.
No, it's good. What's interesting, though, is like when we look at the psychology of time, right, from a historical evolutionary perspective in psychology, it was one of the most sort of transformational evolutionary adaptations that were developed, but it comes at a cost, right? Because knowing about time allows us to predict the future. I mean, there's more to it than that, but we can think about what options we might have and how to take them. We're not just deciding every moment for that moment, right? And so you also sort of begin to introduce this concept of sacrificing the present for the future and being able to store food for the future and knowing that, like, in the winter months, the harvest is going to be low, and so it's good to save in the summer months or whatever in order to compensate for the winter months so you're not scrambling and starving. And I mean, it's interesting because, like, some animals have a primitive view of that anyway, right? Like, yeah, this sort of hibernation idea, but we know that we're doing it. We can think about it. Whereas, as far as we know, animals just sort of do it. They're not exactly sure why they're doing it, perhaps.
It's
hard to know.
This is the problem. I think mankind thinks that mankind is very clever.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I don't actually agree. Yeah, because when we get, and anybody who's had a dog or a cat or, you know, a pet, even fish, yeah, if you keep fish, if you're the keeper of those fish, you will have a communication with them. It's kind of weird, but when people have pets, that person can communicate to that pet. Yeah, you know, I mean, hence, I mean, nowadays you've got pet psychologists. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? Yeah. I hope you're not going down that route, Shane. Stay with me. But you know what? My dog has, you know, got Cushing's disease and he's depressed. Is it what? I mean, sadly, the more animals spend time with us, the crazier they get.
Yeah, they pick up on our energy, for lack of a better word.
Yeah, I think Ronnie Lang, who's a Scottish psychiatrist. Have you read any of Ronnie Lang? Oh, you're going to love him. Check good. Ronnie Lang. R.D. Lang. Yeah.
Okay.
A favorite of not. He spent a lot of time studying schizophrenia.
Mm.
And he broke it down beautifully. Schiz, like broken. Yeah. And phrenia or phronos from the heart or mind or spirit. He said, so why on earth would you treat somebody with a broken spirit, a broken heart, with medication when it simply will not mend it? You know, you need to connect with them, reconnect and help them reconnect with themselves. So some beautiful work. So he was anti-pharmaceutical industry. Back in the 50s when these guys were really beginning to ramp up. So some fantastic work. And he said that schizophrenia was it was a very, very good response to living in the current reality.
Okay.
Because he said, so in order adaptive... for us, yeah, because in order for us to be here and now, we are victims of our parents' repression.
Right.
You see what I mean? Every time the generations before have conformed and conformed, so you and I sit here today and we're the product of all of our ancestors' conformity.
Sure.
So really just opens your mind up a little further, you know?
Yeah, well, both conformity and sort of creativity and growth, right? And non-conformity. It's just sort of perhaps more conformity than not. But that's maybe the cost of living in civilization, right? But I understand what you're saying.
You see what I mean?
Yeah.
Should it be a cost of... And who says civilized? And another point Lang says is normal. He says, normal people scare me. So because normal people go out and they get medals. They get medals for killing people. That's what normal does. So it's kind of interesting. Our military is normal. Yeah. Our health service was once thought to be normal, but that's another story.
Yeah. No, it's a fair point. And, you know, it's a weird part of our psychology, both individually and collectively, this idea of normality and fitting in. And interestingly, we seem to be at a point where we're moving not away from this idea of normal, but like that there's many different options for people and they're all okay, right? And that's good progress, I would say.
Yeah.
You know, within reason, right? Because you can't necessarily permit everything in a civilization if you want to live in a civilization. Like, you can't let people just decide to go stealing and killing people without punishment because they feel like that's normal and that they're entitled to do that. Like, it's a complicated topic.
Well, no, it isn't really complicated.
No?
It isn't really complicated because if you Google common law, it's all there for you. It's very simple. Yeah. The problem we've got is that we're not living under common law. We're living under this manufactured system that is inhuman. It causes harm. Now, in common law, it literally says, do no harm.
You know, right.
Act in honor. Now, that allows you to do whatever the heck you want to in your bedroom with your, you know, your partner, your friends, your buddies, whatever. But maybe you don't parade the streets with it. But still, if you're not doing harm, can you see what I mean? It's an old code that has really got us a long way.
Yeah.
But the problem we've got now is this legalese, which is not original law, common law. You guys, we all come under common law.
Yeah. I mean, legalese is terrible. And I'm I'm all for these new sort of initiatives to get rid of that stuff and make it all readable and accessible. I mean, if you ever try to read a legal document.
Hitherto, henceforth, therefore.
Circumstances pertain to this and that, and you're like, even talking, you know, like make people understand things. But to sort of just like, return back to our conversation.
We went off.
So we were talking about how. So let's look at it from this perspective, right? We're a product of both our genetics and our environmental upbringing and things like that, right? And when people are young or babies or even in utero, if you want to go that far, events occur. And they change the way we are in the world, right? And it's good and bad, but the bad ones tend to be particularly relevant to people because they cause long-term consequences, right? This is the sort of adverse childhood experience model and trauma and complex trauma and things like that. And it doesn't even have to be one event. It can be multiple or it can be ongoing. And, you know, people go through hell. Like, by all means, that's like the real... best way to describe it. And we as a biological entity are designed to adapt to anything in order to survive, right? Whatever that looks like. And sometimes that looks like the need for dissociation, right? Because the pain is too much to bear.
Yeah.
Which psychologically then, if it happens too much, it becomes a problem. So it's an adaptive response in the moment, but it's not adaptive later on, right? And that's because we have this memory, which you call an emotional memory image.
Yeah.
This sort of stored idea about how things are and what we need to be afraid of. And very often it ranges between in terms of how much we know about it, right? Like anyone who's had a history of severe trauma knows that seemingly insignificant triggers, like a sound or a smell or a visual image that's seemingly unrelated, can immediately trigger the trauma response, right? Which is the same fight, flight, freeze, whatever it is.
Yeah.
And it can be debilitating, right? Panic attacks, whatever. And so in some sense, it happens unconsciously, but you can also bring that to conscious awareness, and that's what therapy does and things like that. But what you have been working on in this system, in part EMDR, which is eye movement desensitization and
You broke off for a second then. So maybe.
Oh, sorry.
Yeah, back again.
Which point?
So back what again? What I've been working on, and then you froze.
Yeah, so sure. So what you've been working on, as far as I understand it, is how do we help people recognize and reprocess these memories in order to live more adaptively and with less anxiety and less stress and all these kinds of things. And much of your approach, you know, like you have this app, which is called Mind Reset, which is great. Or we can talk about it more a bit later. But one of the things it's founded on is EMDR, which is eye movement desensitization and reintegration, which is a fantastic new therapeutic modality that uses eye movement to activate certain regions in your brain, such that when you bring memories to mind in conjunction with using this eye movement technique, the emotional, like the experience or the intensity of the valence of the emotional experience decreases, such that you can reintegrate that memory in a more healthy way, right? That's the sort of a rough premise of EMDR.
Yeah.
But it's shown to be remarkably effective for trauma and things like that. And so where exactly does sort of, let's say, your and Mark's theory come to play in terms of all of that, in terms of like reintegrating these memories, or, you know, getting rid of the emotional memory image?
Well, if we stick with there's some wonderful work from Bruce Ecker,
mm-hmm.
and Bruce Ecker looks at memory consolidation, and I really we fit on that bridge between memory consolidation and EMDR.
Okay,
and what we're looking at is the moment before the problem comes into consciousness. So if we say to a client, what would you like to work with? The client subconsciously will flick and access the emotional memory image.
Mm-hmm.
And simultaneously as they do that, they take a breath in. And then we interrupt. And we interrupt for a number of reasons. Reason number one is if we interrupt immediately, the client is still not conscious of what they have just accessed. And so the snowball has not begun the journey down the hill, down the mountain. So if we interrupt in that split second, nothing has activated.
Mm-hmm.
The system's about to warm up. And we stop it. So by stopping it, then the client then from an EMDR position, they've accessed a spot. But from a memory consolidation position, the action of activating that spot has now revivified or reactivated all of the chemistry necessary that was present in the original event. So now we have a malleable memory.
Mm-hmm.
And there are three things that we bring into the process. And these three things have been shown, thanks to Ecker's work in memory consolidation, they have been shown through meta-analysis of many, many psychotherapeutic interventions and studies, that they've been shown to be the keys
mm-hmm.
to rapid intervention. And very, very simply, one is we get the client into the context, which obviously would get those neurons firing. And two, we give them a mismatch or something that's conflicting with their evidence of the problem. And then three, we have them run through it or future pace it. So those three pieces, so long as they appear in the process, will shift that emotional memory image.
Okay.
So that, that's, again, if you look at Ecker's work, but it's also in our second paper that's under review, to really show you do not need hours upon hours of therapy. All you need is to be able to access that memory, just touch it for a moment. And then let's interrupt it. But if we think from a neurochemical basis, if you access it fully, the cortisol levels, you know, all of the stress toxins will be flooding your system too late.
Mm.
Now, we've all experienced this. When if you go and ask your mom or your dad for a loan, and the first thing you want to know is, what mood is mom or dad in?
Right.
If they're in a good mood, great. If not, no way. You see what I mean?
Come back another time.
So if they just had a blazing row, you know not to ask. You've got to wait until you're there. And you get a sense the air's good, the chemistry's good. Now's my chance. Yeah?
Mm-hmm.
And so if we then shrink that into a therapeutic moment, all we need to do is have the client touch, just momentarily touch that emotional memory image so that the system's about to warm, and then we jump in and we see it, we point out to them everything that they've just done in the last split second. Now, okay. It's outside of their awareness. But because we're bringing it into their awareness, now they're curious.
Right.
Curiosity is the chemistry, the chemical state that they were in before that event happened. As I said earlier, if you're looking at an 18-month-year-old child, it's just full of dopamine and full of curiosity.
Now, when you say curiosity, do you mean like openness?
Openness, yeah.
Because I'm thinking of like, what happens when someone's in a car crash,
yeah. Right?
The moment before, they weren't necessarily curious about anything. They were just sort of present and open, hopefully,
yeah.
Driving on the road, or alternatively distracted in their head or on their phone, hopefully not. And then the car crash happens, and then, you know, trauma. And so reaccessing that memory, if I understand what you're saying correctly, in this context is you, to use our car crash example. So you sort of say to someone, And actually, you're working on an app that you can do this by yourself.
You do yourself.
You don't
yourself,
even need
yeah.
someone, right? Mind Reset. Download it. It's great. I've been using it. Is that you start thinking about that memory, right? So you access the emotional memory image. And before your body responds physiologically to that to such a degree that it basically shuts any constructive thinking or conversation out, you interrupt it. And that takes the form. It can take the form of anything. Your app uses a baby laughing.
Yeah.
And in that, which I like, it's a good one because it also that's a universally welcomed sound. Right?
That's what we thought. But believe it or not, there are still some people who get really spooked and upset that you're using a baby laughing. I mean, it's the most infectious. Yeah. Wonderful little giggle you could have. Nope. I mean, and the number of giggles we had to go through, you know, to get the one that just made us all of us go.
Yeah.
So
you can't please everyone.
Yeah.
But I agree that it's a pretty universal.
It should
pick me up.
It should be.
Maybe people are just too upset to sort of appreciate it in the moment, or yeah. The first time I heard it, I was like, "What's happened?" But the second I was like, oh, I know it's coming, but it's fine. And so when that happens, it interrupts the
connection,
process,
the
connection.
Flow. Yeah.
Right. And then so where I'm a little bit stuck is, so then what happens after that? Right. So you've interrupted the cycle. And now we move into the sort of new consolidation phase, which is what I guess you call the unlearning response,
yeah.
right? So could you explain a little bit more about
yeah.
that?
So basically, when we make that interruption, mm-hmm. if you think about it, it's on a loop. It's an unconscious loop, and it's streaming. It's been streaming since it began. But it depends on how far you want me to go down, because if we look from a quantum physical aspect, yeah, there is only now.
Yeah.
So when, if we use your car crash example, when you had the car crash, you're about to have the car crash.
Mm-hmm.
And it hasn't happened yet. And it has. And you haven't learned to drive yet. You haven't even gotten the car. All of these are possibilities within a quantum realm.
Okay.
Yeah,
I know what you're saying. Yeah, yeah,
yeah. I hope your listeners hang on in there. Right. So if we look at quantum theory from a position of entanglement,
yeah.
So quantum entanglement, basically, if we take two, let's call them atoms, for simplicity's sake, two atoms that were once one, and we separate them, and what we find with quantum physics is, no matter how large that distance is, those two atoms are still intimately connected.
Mm-hmm.
And the problem is, we don't know how. But they've done all of these theories, so if one flipped heads, instantly the other one lands tails. So then, if we follow this train of thought, bearing in mind quantum physics has been blocked out of the therapeutic field as well as other fields of science for too long. But if we allow this to come into our practice and allow our clients to understand how the quantum effect works, at the moment that car crash happened, you, whether conscious or not, your system thought you were about to die. And, you know, in the blink of an eye, your system thought, I'm dead.
Mm-hmm.
Now, if you didn't know it, it was a rear end shunt, and you wake up in hospital, yeah, you think, well, how can I be having a trauma now? Because I can't even remember the accident or whatever. You see what I mean? So how can I still have a trauma? Well, yeah, you might have been unconscious, but you weren't dead.
Yeah.
So your system's still listening. Your ears, you know, are always listening.
Mm-hmm.
So when the fire crew came and were cutting you out of the car and everything, you're still unconscious. You think, well, how have I got a trauma? I wasn't even. Your system would have still been onboarding.
Mm-hmm.
So all of that is then entangled in you. But 6 months after the accident, you've moved on. However, 6 months later is no space and time, because that you that's just going into the accident is resonating trauma.
Mm-hmm.
So when we break that connection, we're breaking the quantum entanglement. So you're becoming one again. So the energy that the trauma was costing you was spilling out across time.
Mm-hmm.
When we interrupt that connection, what we're doing is we're cutting it so that snap, you're back again. Instead of spreading yourself across through time and space. Does that make sense?
Yeah, yeah.
So,
and so it integrates.
That, by the way, is not in paper one. They said, if you put that into paper one, they definitely will not let you publish. So I'm waiting for more people to come along so that I can really let loose with where we are with the theory. But that's actually, in essence, what we're doing with the app. So in Mind Reset, we're interrupting the quantum flow. And in so doing, we're collapsing that entanglement.
And so, I don't know what the right way to phrase this question is, but how many times? Give it your best. Yeah. How many times do you think you have to do that before it's sufficiently shut?
Right. Well done. If it's it's based on my almost 30 years of practice.
Okay.
So, and it's cutting edge software.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, it's priced at like $10 or whatever. So it's really, really cheap. So we can help as many people as possible, but it also has a free version in there. So we can help even more people. So yeah, we've done the best we can, but it's not the best yet, because what we're aiming for, and you know, the next round of funding that we get is really cool, because I mentioned in some of the pushback we got was because we want to take the therapist out of the room.
Yeah.
Now, if we remove the therapist from the room, you can imagine there's an awful lot of pushback from therapists.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Taking their livelihood away.
Shane's looking across the scissors. I'm busy training in this, but yeah, just a thought.
No, it's cool. I'm open to it.
Because you will have been studying about the power position. Yeah. A therapist has a lot of power.
Yes.
Yeah. Allocated to them by virtue of it, the client is coming in a vulnerable position. Mm-hmm. And also, in order to be a client, the client has to break with autonomy, their own autonomy. The client has to say to you, help me, I am, you know, in need of help. That is not a natural position for any human being to take.
Yeah. You don't think so?
It's not natural.
But we're social creatures,
though. Yeah, we're social creatures. Yeah. But if we open up our vulnerabilities, there's a chance of being expelled from the tribe.
Yeah, but the alternative isn't much better, right? To be fully reserved and try and deal with everything yourself.
Oh, no, absolutely not. I fundamentally agree. Yeah. We're modern people. There's more things. And I'm not disagreeing. What I'm saying is, try telling that to your amygdala.
Yeah. Yeah.
You see, the system. This is, we can all, you know, pontificate from the smart brain, and we'll all agree. However, the amygdala, the limbic system says no. And yeah, as we've covered already, if the limbic system says no, you ain't playing.
Yeah. But sometimes, right? Because people do open themselves up even when they don't want to. Right? So you can actually sometimes make that choice. I'm not arguing with your premise. I'm just like, let's explore this idea, right?
Yeah,
because where I'm confused is like, now maybe this is just my learning and conditioning speaking, right? So
maybe
it seems to be it seems to be the case that they say that vulnerability, so first of all, we're all vulnerable.
Yeah.
Like there is no doubt about it. Everyone's going to die. Tiny little holes in your body will end your life, right?
Yeah.
No one is invulnerable. Now, knowing that is actually, it empowers you.
Yeah.
And there's an important distinction to make between vulnerability and weakness.
Yes, absolutely.
And I think it's a relatively intuitive distinction in that being vulnerable means knowing that you are susceptible to attack or to, you know, danger and harm. Weakness is not being able to defend against it or not taking action when you should and things like that. And weakness is something to work on, and vulnerability, you can kind of, you can establish certain protective mechanisms. But in human relationships, though, vulnerability tends to bond people together.
Yeah.
Now, it is the case that when you're vulnerable with someone, you open yourself up to that vulnerability being not used against you, but you basically expose your chest and, you know, you're now open to attack. And that's very difficult for people to do, some more than others. But doing so is really where like deep emotional intimacy comes in, right? And bonding between people. And so I'm just wondering, and that's why, you know, they say in the therapeutic environment, the relationship between the client and the therapist is the tool of transformation. It is the number one predictor of success in therapy, not the modality used. It's not the number of sessions. It's none of stuff. Nearly as important as the relationship that you establish.
Yeah.
And that relationship has to be established on a foundation of willing to be open, which involves trust, right? And then continuing with that, where the client comes in and says, this is what I've done, this is who I am, these are all my flaws and things like, and strengths, and, you know, the whole package. And the therapist accepts that without judgment, right? And that's where you establish that you can actually have relationships with people where you are vulnerable, and that being vulnerable allows other people to help you in times of need. Right now, you might not want that to be the case, but for most people, that does tend to be the case. Now, I agree with you in saying that it's great to give people autonomy in terms of most things, right? And that's actually very much encouraged in therapy as well, where you're not, and I'm just explaining this for people listening, right? It's like a lot of people think that you come to therapy and the therapist solves the client's problems for them or tells them what to do or how to do it or whatever. And most of the time, it's actually the case that you work, as a client, you work with the therapist to decide for yourself what your best option is and how to start taking that action towards achieving that goal. And it's whatever you decide is best, because you don't want to take people's autonomy away. Because if a therapist makes the decision for you, then you're not making any decisions. And also, you won't then feel accomplished in yourself for doing it, because you're like, well, I didn't decide to do this. And the reverse side of it is, if it goes bad, which it can, then you'll blame the therapist. And that's not helpful for anyone. So autonomy is, I agree, very fundamental to prospering in life, right? So where I'm wondering is like, you know, where do you see that as like, sort of the problem, that vulnerability?
Vulnerability isn't the problem.
Okay.
It's not a vulnerability. If a human being is able to open himself up and be vulnerable, It is an awesome power.
Mm-hmm.
There's no doubt about it. If you're able to open yourself up and to, here I am, as Oliver Cromwell put it, warts and all. Yeah. If you're able to do that, then wow, that's a superhuman being. Now, what I'm chatting about is autonomy itself.
Okay.
So take away vulnerability, etc. Autonomy. In order to have absolute autonomy, one must learn to fish. It's nice to be given a fish, but to have autonomy, one must learn to fish.
Mm-hmm.
So that's why we're super excited where we're heading with the app, because we're looking in the next stages to bring AI learning.
Okay.
So that way, it's you with you.
Yes.
So, because from a therapeutic standpoint, the therapist really wants to have the client explore possibilities, but we're not nudging, cajoling, we're just having them explore possibilities, upon which somewhere during that journey, the client has gone the journey with the therapist, has learned that actually it is possible to trust someone. It is possible to have a relationship where that is safe. So all of those pieces matter, of course.
Mm-hmm.
What we're looking at is from stripping it right the way back, because if we can give a human being full autonomy to have an almost real-time conversation with a system that's going to chat to them, that's going to really, and I mean, if you look at AI learning now, it's so awesome.
Mm.
So that I don't have to break with autonomy, because that system doesn't want my details or anything, and it's learning from me about me.
Right.
So that way, it moves a step closer, because the original question was, you know, really, we're looking at how good, how many sessions, etc. So if it's with me, it's only ever one session, because I've got the flexibility to adjust and move and make it happen. When we attach AI, we get that learning built in. That's the ultimate position for mind reset.
Right.
So that it can literally work with you to find where it is. Because what happens is, at the moment, a lot of people, they use it, like a client the other day messaged us and said, he's trouble sleeping. When he wakes up at 3 a.m, he uses the sleep app.
Mm.
I said, too late. The horse has bolted. The cortisol is now flooded in your system. So when's the best time to use the sleep app? What about the day, during the day before you went to bed? Because tonight is still going to arrive, and your system knows exactly what you're going to be up to during tonight. So if we do it ahead of time, our system is still smart enough to figure that out. So can you see what I mean? It's really getting used to realizing this isn't an elastoplast. You know, this isn't to put on afterwards. It's preventative. So that's why it's really kind of cool. And it's getting used to sort of clearing your mind.
Yeah.
You know, most people, that wouldn't be water. That would be a vodka or a gin and tonic or something. Yeah. But I prefer water myself. But whatever it is they need to clear their mind. But actually, it clears it for you in less than 2 minutes.
Yeah, you're developing the habit so that when you need
it, brushing your teeth,
you can do it. Yeah. And I mean, that's true of all meditative practices. They're like, don't do it when you're super stressed and high strung. Like, that's not the time. I mean, it's also the time, but the time to develop it is when things are good, yeah, going well. And that's when you should start building the habit and the strength and the reflex so that when you need it, it's there.
It's there.
And not trying to do it at the time as well, right? So that's a great thing. And I really enjoy using the app. I think it's great. And it really just does provide that sort of like that break in your shift, in your train of thought, right? It's like it just does, right? And I like that after phone calls and stuff, it's like, hey, do you want a quick reset? And also that it's fully private, right? Like there's no details of anything.
We have nothing. I mean, seriously, we're chatting to investors and said, this is a terrible business model. And we said, we know.
Yeah.
And they said, why are you smiling? We just told you it's a terrible business model. We said, I know. It's a beautiful business model. It's just terrible for business.
Yeah.
But it's beautiful for human beings because nobody can actually get their head around. We don't have any data on any of our users.
Yeah.
And for me, that's really beautiful.
Yeah. And it's so important.
Because a lot of organizations take your data and then they say, we promise to keep your data safe. Yeah. And we really trust them. That's a problem. We don't trust anyone nowadays except ourselves. Yeah. And maybe a few friends, but trust is such, it's really in jeopardy. So
and we don't have a choice. If you want to use the product, that's what you got to do, right?
And with our product, you don't have to.
Yeah.
You know, it's kind of refreshing. You know,
and it's amazing.
People can check us out and say, no, we don't have your data. And in this day and age, it's unbelievable. But we thought, well, there has to be a shift. We need a better way to help individuals. Now, tracking, I don't know about you, but if you imagine if you were a stag, a wild animal, and if you think about tracking, if that stag knows it's being tracked, it will never rest.
Yeah.
And here we are with these devices. Even when they're switched off, I'm told, they still know where you are.
Yeah, can't take the battery out anymore either.
You can. So we're being monitored and tracked 24/7. Now, what does that do when mentally, if you hold that thought just for a moment, that's got to have some sort of ripple effect in our energy field.
Right.
So we're not tracking you guys, Googlers or Apple, whoever, but just not us.
Yeah. No, it's great. And it's so important. And I think that despite the sort of non-business model, that's how many of the greatest companies and inventions worked, was people were telling them like, no, this isn't going to work. It's a bad idea. Do the what's known to be good and work. Like, you know, stick to the known scripts for success. And then the people who didn't, I mean, sometimes it doesn't work, but sometimes it really works. And then you get these like unbelievable things that everyone's just like, how did that happen? You know, it's so transformative. And I wish you guys all of that success. And I hope that, you know, people use it and appreciate it and that you can really help some people because it's certainly needed.
That's what the idea of putting the free basis in there as well, just because, you know, people might be able to afford a mobile phone, but they may not be able to afford a few books. So we've got a free version in there too. So we're doing our bit.
Yeah. And more than that. And we'll do the word to spread it, to, you know, spread out and get people to download and share it and try it. Listen, Matt, thank you so much for coming on today. It's been an absolute blast and I really appreciate it. Please promote yourself, your website, how can people reach you if they want to book a session or anything like that?
I don't really want to book many sessions in. You know, okay. I got plenty of clients. I've been in this game for too long now, too long. If they want to check out matthudson.com, That's my website. And if they want to check out the Mind Reset, obviously they can find Mind Reset on their mobile phone. But also there's mindreset.app, which is a website there. Yeah.
Brilliant. Okay. And I'll put them all in the description.
This has been a hoot.
Yeah, it's been so much fun. And I'll put all of those links in the descriptions for people to just click on and access easily. But yeah, thank you. And I look forward to the next one. We have so much more to discuss.
I'm sure we do. Brilliant.
All right. Thanks, Matt. Take care.
Bye.
We'll be right back.